Let me go back to a topic suggested earlier by your remarks about CORE. I know some of the criticisms and difficulties that have come to the NAACP because of interracial character. Now, have you had the same experience with CORE?
Because of the interracial character?
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of the criticisms reached NAACP on that basis.
Yeah.
By Lomax, by Alan Clayton Powell, by many other sources. Uh-huh.
Well, Powell included us in his criticism of the NAACP.
That's right, yes.
He criticized NAACP and CORE for having white people in positions of leadership. Well, CORE, from its very beginning, has been an interracial organization, and this with us is a matter of principle. We don't see how we can fight for an open society through a segregated organization. And this is a policy position which we intend to maintain. We have an interracial staff at all levels. Our offices are both Negro and white. The membership in all of our chapters, except the chapters in the Deep South, are Negro and white. We expect to maintain it. Of course, we run into difficulty. I expect that this difficulty will increase rather than decrease in the next few years.
Okay, what kind of difficulty, Mr. Farmer?
Well, there are many, many Negroes who do not work, will not work in an organization that's interracial because of their suspicion of whites, because of the distrust which they have for whites. Some of this suspicion and distrust is a result of bad experiences of the past, but more basically, I think it's a result of the fact that we've lived in separated worlds for so long. Negroes have grown up in a black world, whites in a white world. Many of the youngsters who have come into the civil rights movement within the past 2 years have had no interracial experiences at all. The only white people they have had any dealings with have been their landlords or their bosses.
This leads to something else now. For instance, the most publicized remark bearing on it is from James Baldwin. That is, the white liberal is an affliction, a famous remark. And we hear in many forms elsewhere. What is the role of this character, the white liberal?
Well, as you know,
does he have any role in the Negro revolution, or whatever you choose to call it?
Well, white liberal has become a bad word.
It's a bad word.
Like Uncle Tom, like moderate, you name it. I think the white liberal does have a role. At the present stage of the civil rights struggle, his role cannot be one of leading the struggle. He cannot be the top leader of any of the civil rights organizations if those organizations are to have any impact in the Negro community right now. If there is a white leader of the organization, then the organization will become irrelevant as far as Negroes are concerned. I think that the white liberals must and certainly should be willing to work within the organization in the rank and file and in roles of secondary leadership and as technicians, that is, persons who have certain skills which cannot easily be found in the Negro community now because Negroes have not had the opportunity to develop them. A part of CORE's strength is the fact that we have an interracial staff.
Now, what about the white man who is outside the organization? He comes in for a little bit different treatment. Say, fellow traveler, put it that way. The person who's concerned with the state of the health of the entire community and subsumes the Negro situation under this bias, as it were, or this idea, rather than in terms of organization. You are that kind of man?
Yes, I do. I do indeed. Just thinking about it for a moment.
President Johnson is one, for instance.
Yeah.
We trust.
Yes, he is. On President Johnson, I'd say that I think he has a real dedication and commitment on the civil rights issue. His speeches, especially the speeches in the South, have been very significant, in my opinion. Furthermore, he has taken some stands which do not seem to be calculated to help him politically. It's a matter of conviction and a feeling, an emotional matter with him, too. So I respect him for it.
I do, too, by the way. I'm not...
Yeah.
Staring at him.
But the question you raise is a good one, a valid one. The feeling in the Negro community now is that this is the key issue, and all other issues must be secondary. And if there's any conflict between the two issues, this one must prevail. If there's a conflict between fighting militantly for civil rights and a civil liberties point of view, for example, then the civil rights issue must prevail. My own view is that all of these issues are so definitely interrelated that while the civil rights issue is the key domestic issue of our time, we have got now to begin bridging the gap and showing the relationship between the struggle for equal rights for Negroes and the struggle for a stronger and better America. I think the civil rights movement can make, as one of its most significant contributions, providing motivation and thrust, for example, toward solving the problem of poverty in our country, solving the problem of unemployment, because it happens that Negroes are the poorest of the poor. We are the most unemployed of the unemployed, and we are the poorest housed of the ill-housed, and they have the worst health of the poor health, the people of poor health.
You find situations like this. A white man I know, who's quite a distinguished writer, has had some pressure for him to become an activist, at least associate himself outside. He has written very eloquently and is planning on something that's very important, which will be on this subject. And I'll be totally committed to it.
Yeah.
Yet he has come in some very harsh words because he won't go march.
Oh, yes. Well, we've gone through that stage, and I think it's just a stage, and I think we're just about through it now, where we feel that the feeling has been that the only important contribution a person can make is in the streets. There are some people who will not be in the streets for various reasons, marching with us. But there are other things that they can do. And in a sense, it's been our failure in not having pointed out the specific things which they can do to help the revolution, the civil rights revolution. If the civil rights revolution is to succeed, then we have got to work out methods of using people at the level in which they are able to operate to help the cause. We haven't done that effectively. We're trying to do it now.
And we find this also about certain Negroes. Ralph Ellison comes to mind. He is a man of enormous talents and high distinction.
Yeah.
Did you see in Dissent last fall the article by Irving Howe called Black Boys and Native Son?
Yes, yes.
And Ralph Ellison's replies in New Leader?
I didn't see the replies.
He wrote two very eloquent pieces in reply. He said, Irving Howe is a new kind of Bilbo. He's picked my place out for me and puts me in it. That Ralph Rowe is outside of activism, but he's enormously effective.
Mm-hmm.
But he's comes in for a great deal of criticism from both people like Howe and a certain Negroes I know,
mm-hmm.
because he hasn't been in the streets. It's the same thing of more sharply focused.
Yes, well, in the case of Ralph Ellison, I don't know whether the criticism is only that he hasn't been in the streets. Baldwin, for example, has not been in the streets.
Yes.
But his writing has been oriented toward the streets.
Well, The Invisible Man has had an enormous impact. Ralph's novel
has an
impact that is probably more than any single, very few men have had an impact.
Yeah. That's true. Well, I would reiterate what I've said.
Yes.
That, I think now we've got to find roles that others can play to help the revolution, which will not necessarily be picketing or marching or sitting in. Black or white. We need their talents. I attended an interesting meeting yesterday in which there was discussion of a relatively new idea of urging people who have money and who invest that money to tithe in their investments. In other words, to see to it that one-tenth of the funds which they invest are invested in a planned and deliberate attempt at creating open occupancy housing, and that they also follow the other money that they invest by seeing to it that their money is not unwittingly being used to support and maintain segregation. I think this is something that people can do.
Adam Clayton Powell said to me some weeks ago, the leadership of the organizations is finished. They are dead. But they can only muster 900,000 people all together, and those are a lot of duplicates. Their phase is over.
Well,
I know you don't agree with that.
Of
How would you
not.
Argue it?
Well, I'd say that reports of our death have been greatly exaggerated. I would say that Adam Clayton Powell would have great difficulty mobilizing 900 people, not to speak of 900,000 people. I'd say that as far as CORE is concerned, we are growing constantly. We are doubling at least each year and have been growing at that rate for the past 3 years. And I see no end to it in sight.
Now, the big change in the role of CORE was when, let's see, in 50 Decidians. Greensboro City was a big turning point, wasn't it?
That was one turning point. Yeah, that was the major one in 1960, the student Decidians in the South.
Yes.
I would say that we had an earlier spurt of growth about 1957 as a result of the Montgomery bus boycott and the King's leadership. Then at that point, you see, the technique of nonviolence became popularized, and this was a technique CORE had been using for some 14 to 15 years. We had a growth in 1960, then we had additional speedy growth in 1961 with the Freedom Rides, which were a CORE project.
Yes, I remember that.
So that 3 years ago, we had 23 chapters and about 12,000 members. Now, 3 years later, we have 175 chapters and at least 75,000 members. So our day is not ended. We haven't reached our peak.
In the question of the leadership, general leadership of the movement, in ordinary revolutions historically considered, we find that the tendency is always toward centralization of power, winding up usually in a person.
Yes.
That's the power.
Yeah.
Who has a symbolic role as well as a practical role in power.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see this tendency in the Negro movement toward centralization of power?
No, quite to the contrary. The present tendency is toward proliferation of leadership and diffusion of power. There is no one Negro leader now. There are Negro leaders on local levels, regional levels, and more or less national levels springing up every week as the movement becomes larger. And I myself do not see this as a liability. I think it's much more of an asset. I think it strengthens the total movement. It creates ferment within the movement and tension within the movement, it's true. But it keeps all of us on our toes.
Now, this ferment in the movement and tension within the movement is putting against the notion of a united front, though, isn't it? In leadership or in policy.
Well, no, I'd say that there are two trends. There's a trend toward proliferation of leadership, and there's also a trend toward greater coordination.
Now, these, at first glance, are contradictory, aren't they?
Yes. But actually, I think they are not. There, you will find that within the past 2 or 3 years, there has been a rash of unity committees or councils on local levels. Almost every major city has its United Civil Rights Committee, which includes CORE, the NAACP, and frequently the Urban League, and so forth. On a national level, we have a number of such groups. We have the Civil Rights Leadership Conference, of which Roy Wilkins is chairman. We have the Council for United Civil Rights Leadership, which includes six or seven of the major civil rights organizations, including CORE, with a rotating chairmanship. My time is next. Currently, Whitney Young is chairman of the group, and I'll follow him. We had the March on Washington Committee, which was a unity committee, too. So I think that you find this development running parallel with the proliferation of leadership.
There's another question that's always emerging in the discussion of popular-based movements or in revolutions. As leadership is open, up for grabs, you know.
Yes.
Ambitious men act ambitiously. And there is a kind of overreaching in promises.
Uh-huh.
Promises to the public.
Yes.
Or overreaching in terms of appeals to all sorts of dark, you know, motives of violent expression and emotionalisms of various kinds.
Uh-huh.
Now, clearly from the newspapers, one sees there's something of that going on.
Of course.
It's inevitable.
Of course.
Now, do you anticipate any real danger from that, or how is that to be contained, put it that way? This human and natural impulse, pattern at all?
Well, I think that this tendency will go on. I don't see any way to avoid it. There will be jockeying for positions of power, jockeying for leadership. There will be internecine warfare. This is inevitable because the stakes are so high and the prize is so great that ambitious men will let their ambition run rampant. I would say that actually it's not a bad thing to have this vying for leadership. The competition in itself tends to be good. The competition is good in that it keeps us on our toes. If we go to sleep, then somebody else is going to replace us. We cannot afford to rest. We cannot afford to sleep, but we must keep on the alert. I would say, in addition, that there is a tendency within the movement now for verbalism to be substituted for leadership or to be confused with leadership. One can gain a following, at least temporarily,